thanks. Thank you very much for setting the scene since 2001 with the wars, devastating wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and the oppression of the Palestinian people living under occupation. And actually not a war on terror, but a rise of terror, rise of terrorism. So our next speaker is Dr. Craig Jones. He's a lecturer in political geography at Newcastle University. Craig's areas of specialization include armed conflict, international law, and the Middle East. And he's written several articles on Palestine, Iraq, and Afghanistan. His talk today is based on his new book, The War Lawyers, United States, Israel, and Juridical Warfare, published by Oxford University Press in November 2020. So Craig will present his monograph that examines the laws of war interpreted and applied by military lawyers to aerial targeting operations carried out by the US military in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Israel military in Gaza. Thank you, Craig.
Great, thank you so much, Pam, and thank you, Alex, for the kind introduction and background setting. It's really nice to be able to talk in front of you tonight, so thank you all so much for joining. It's really nice. It's especially nice to be among this audience. Recently, as in this week and the last couple of weeks, I've given a couple of versions of this talk, but the crowds have not been quite my cup of tea. I've been talking with some military lawyers and military people in the US presenting this stuff, including to some lawyers also down in Oxford. Well, we come from different worldviews, let's say. And so the groundwork that I have to do it all myself. It's not set for me. So thanks for setting the tone there, Alex. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go ahead and speak for about 20 to 25 minutes. If I go over, Pam, please do send me a message or just start yelling at me. I have prepared a presentation. I hope it's sort of image heavy rather than text heavy. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen now. Pam, can you see that? Everyone? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, well, I'm really happy to be here presenting the new book. It just came out in November. It's something I've worked on for a long time. It was my PhD, something I've worked on for nearly 10 years. And so it's just nice to have it in the world. It's nice to see what people think of it, have people read it and react to it, both positively and negatively. So I appreciate you being here. And thanks to Stop the War and thanks to Newcastle University Power Space Politics Research Cluster 4 for sponsoring this event. One second. So I wanted to start with an image of the front cover and to tell you a little bit about why it was that I chose this front cover for the book. This is an artistic image by the artist Ellen O'Hara O'Slavic. And it's an image that she took from a newspaper in 1991. On the day after the bombing of Baghdad in 1991 in the first Gulf War. And this was a newspaper article published in the US, and it was a map that was marked all of the places with a little X that the US had bombed the previous night, obviously sold as a sort of success story on the initial eve of that bombing campaign. That bombing campaign was a short one, just lasted 45 days, but the devastation it left is, as Alex has sort of suggested, is very much still with Iraq. And so what Ellen did as an artist is took that image, traced it, as you can see, and replaced the sort of crosshairs with images of dotted inked blood. And I thought that was appropriate as a sort of metaphor for the sorts of violence that I'm dealing with in the book, and in particular, the legal forms of violence. And it's deliberately jarring, it's deliberately bloody, it deliberately tries to evoke the sense that war has a literal material and bodily cost, because the law has been for a long time now sort of denying that denying that fact, denying the violence that is inherent in the law. And that's really what the book is about. So the book is ultimately about what it says there. It's about lawyers in the war room. And back in 2013, I interviewed one of these military lawyers, one of the most senior military lawyers in Israel. And he told me some of the history about how this came about. But by the early 2000s, he made this comment. He said that it was unheard of to have a lawyer in the war room, in the planning military operation meeting. But now he was talking about the Israeli military in particular, can't move without them. So my book really sets out to explore how it is that historically, for militaries that have been around for centuries, for state militaries that have launched successive wars, even in recent memory across the 20th and 21st century, suddenly at the end of the 20th century and beginning of the first century, decide that they need a new set of legal professionals which hitherto haven't been involved in war. And they decide that they all of a sudden need them, so much so that metaphorically they cannot move, they cannot get military operations done without them. So the book sets out to essentially answer that question as the first question. So why is it that they need military lawyers? And then the second question that it seeks to answer is, what is the consequence? So you say you need military lawyers, but what happens when you invite them into the war room? What do they do? What do they enable military operations to do? And just a little bit of background here on military lawyers. As I sort of mentioned, I mean, these militaries have been around for centuries, and so have military lawyers. The US Military Lawyers Corps, which is where these lawyers belong, it's called the JAG Corps, boasts that it's the oldest and largest law firm in America, which is quite the boast given how large and old some of the law firms are over there. They've been around for centuries, but they didn't do the stuff that I was interested in. They didn't do frontline work. They weren't involved in targeting operations. They weren't often sent to battle. They did the behind-the-scenes stuff, fiscal law, weapons procurement, trying to prepare the battleground, doing military-based contracts, doing soldiers' marital and divorce law and things in the background. But then in the 1990s, in the first Gulf War, hence the image on the front of the book, they become involved in targeting, and they're intimately involved for the first time in the bombing of Iraq in 1990 and some other smaller military operations, including the invasion of Panama around that time as well. But the argument in the book is that they become a really vital part of what the US military calls the kill chain, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on. They become a vital part of the targeting apparatus of military bombing, of aerial campaigns, really at the moment that, you know, Alex talked about there at the start, in terms of that pivotal moment of the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan in 2003 and 2001, respectively. In terms of the scope of the book, just to give you a sense of the outline, it focuses, and Alex might have mentioned this, on two predominant states, the US and Israel, and it looks at their targeting operations in three places: Iraq, Afghanistan, and the territories of Palestine. In terms of the historical focus of the book, it starts in Vietnam. I can say more about why I start in Vietnam a bit later, maybe. I'm not sure if that's as interesting to us, but I'll end up by finishing with Vietnam anyway. And it traces the major wars that the US and Israel has fought really since the Vietnam War up to the present. And it's a sort of a history of technologies of war, of types of war, how warfare has changed across space and time, and thus why military lawyers have come to the fore. Just in terms of what I did, as I mentioned, it was something that I've worked on for many years. It was something partly that I worked on for many years because it's a difficult area to research. They deal with sensitive military operations. But what I did over several years is did interviews with military lawyers and with operators. That just sort of means anyone loosely involved in targeting, intelligence analysts, drone pilots, and so on. I did a series of interviews with them in military bases in the Middle East and across the United States at various different locations. And then I won't go too much into it, but you know, I'll say very few things that defend the Israeli and US militaries tonight. But one thing I will say that makes it easier for research is that they are both prolific authors and publishers of stuff, military stuff, military memos, be they leaked documents, accidentally leaked documents, WikiLeaks type documents, but also what they call military doctrine. They believe in what they do. They train soldiers with course materials, a vast, vast, vast amount if you sort of know where to look. It's certainly not secretly hidden. There are thousands and thousands of pages of stuff, of legal rulings, stuff out there. And you know, one has to trawl through them. It's agonizing work. It's often depressing work because of the sorts of materials. But, you know, just to cite one example, a drone strike that went wrong in 2009 in Afghanistan resulted in a investigation report that was 6,000 pages long. This is one singular drone strike that ended up killing civilians. So it gives you some sense of the sort of archive that's created by war. And then I did some archival research, especially for Vietnam. The argument in the book is this, and sorry for the, this is, I've only got two text heavy slides. This is the first of the two. Stick with me and we can sort of talk more about it, perhaps in the Q&A. There are three, I'm interested in the book in international law. International law, there's lots of different parts of it, but I'm primarily interested in the part that governs war, and there's different names for that. It's called international humanitarian law, sometimes also the laws of armed conflict. But whatever it's called, I'm interested in the laws, the various laws that govern conduct in warfare. And the classical argument that's made about international law, its history, is very much one of a sort of progressive liberal progression that, you know, as we add more laws to treaty law, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions across the 21st century, we arrive at something resembling a sort of more humane, humanitarian form of warfare, which again, Alex usefully alluded to. And this is the sort of conventional historiography, conventional history of the laws of war, that we are moving closer towards a sort of a horizon of humanizing warfare. And that's the tradition that I write against. And I'm in the company of lots of critical scholars who help me to do this, to make three arguments. Firstly, this thing that we call the laws of war is fundamentally indeterminate. And people will disagree with me about this. And I'm often in disagreement with specifically human rights lawyers about this, who sort of very much believe in the law as a tool, that you can, you know, there's such thing as crossing red lines. But my argument is that in some fundamental ways, the laws are indeterminate, which then are exploited. The second argument, that indeterminacy of the law is exploited as an opportunity or a resource for state militaries. And the lingo used by the US and Israel from the 1980s onwards becomes this idea of the law as a force multiplier. Now, I once used that term in a conference where some RAF people were present and nearly got shouted off stage for being a polemicist. What I should have said in the presentation was that this word about force multiplication and force multiplier is something that military lawyers frequently use themselves, and it was sort of their term that I was using. The law is indeterminate. The law can then be exploited because of that indeterminacy, i.e. if it's up for argument, then the militaries can make arguments about what they deem to be reasonable interpretations. I argue that states are more powerful interpreters than human rights lawyers. They're more powerful actors than people like us, perhaps. And thirdly, and most dangerously, which is why I focus on the US and Israel, because state militaries are powerful interpreters of the law, and because of the way that customary law works, customary law means that whatever states do frequently enough, especially if they're powerful states, has a habit of becoming itself international law or customary law itself. And so when that happens, egregious acts, be that the legalization of assassination, be that the targeting of infrastructures, be that bombing civilian populations in cities, has a habit historically of becoming law through time. And therefore, the US and Israel have the power to to legally legislate, you know, what is right and wrong in war. They gain this power, and that's crucial. It has devastating effect, and this is what these military lawyers do, and I argue what they exploit. This has implications. I won't go too deeply into it, but it has implications for contemporary human rights and the sort of anti-war politics that we might be interested in. But it also has sort of scholarly implications for people who are making liberal arguments about law. But loosely, I would say here that people have argued that in the post 9/11 era, if you look at things like Guantanamo Bay, if you look at things like the legalization of torture, people like Jens Olin here argue that international law is being assaulted. It's under attack by the Bush lawyers, by the Cheney lawyers, by John Yoo, who wrote the torture memos. I think that's an important contribution, but I would say that the assault is actually taking place through the medium of law. So international law might well be under assault. It's also under assault by international law itself. So international law, therefore, is part of the problem, I argue, and not necessarily part of the solution. So let me just give you a sort of a quick example of that to make real, if you like, or to ground some of those more broad or sort of conceptual observations. So in order to calculate what the US military deems an acceptable death toll or an acceptable civilian death through a particular strike, they invented a bureaucratic measure that they called the non-combatant cutoff value. So this is, if a strike is going to go ahead, this is the amount of civilians who they foresee, so who they believe they will kill. This does not include any accidental people or any people who come into the picture afterwards, or you know, someone in a building that they didn't know about. So this is a bureaucratic mechanism. And they come up with this, and it changes over time. So in the height of the shock and awe bombing in 2003 in Baghdad, the number of lives that the US military puts on the line, in part through a legal interpretation of the principle of proportionality, that number is 30. And I'll just read some other ones here. During the surge in Iraq, the number goes down to 26. In Afghanistan, by 2010, it's 9. Allegedly, Obama, because he's particularly worried about negative effects of killing civilians in particular areas of Syria and Iraq, puts an NCV of 0, a non-combatant cutoff value of 0. Now all that's getting better, but just to show you that it doesn't necessarily go in that sort of one linear fashion, better and better. The highest number of foreseeable civilian deaths that the US military allowed that I came across, and now bear in mind all of this isn't necessarily public knowledge, it's leaked and you get it from different sources, is this number of 50. And that was for a ISIS bank that they were controlling in Mosul, and the US military deemed that to be such a important military target that they thought that killing 50 civilians is acceptable. And as I say, that's done in part through mechanisms of law, through interpretations of proportionality. The problem with it, and where my argument comes in from my previous slides, is that the military-ness of a bank, or the military-ness, the military importance of a particular target, or what that target is doing, or how important that person is, has a very particular weight in international law and in those calculations. And that's not a transparent weight. We never get shown what that weight is. But it's not unreasonable to say that that weighs so heavy, that military target, that 50 is acceptable. I don't think we as publics, because we don't have access to information, can argue that that's not a reasonable legal interpretation. We can argue it's a violent one and all kinds of things, but I would argue that the best language to meet that with is not a legal vocabulary. It's probably a moral or political vocabulary. And then the second argument that runs through this book, and I'll go across this one a little quicker, is essentially that late forms of modern war And this is where my research really led me, take place over what I call a vast spatial and temporal terrain. And you just need to, for example, start researching the US military to realize quite how extraordinary the times and spaces of the wars that they fight is. And I don't just mean the classic, the US military's got bases all over the world, although of course they do. I literally mean, if you want to look at any particular act that's taking place, for example, a military strike in Mosul has been happening, you know, until fairly recently. You have to look in, 10 or 20 different places in Qatar, where all the operations, the aerial operations take place and where all the technology is, to different military lawyers stationed in different places. Intelligence is coming from Shore Air Force Base back in the continental United States. Drone pilots are flying from Creech Air Force Base. So it is a really complicated geography. And if you want to get a sense of how it is that militaries like the US and Israel come to kill, I think you need to sort of get a hold of those sorts of spaces and those complicated relations and technologies and these people really spread out over space and time. And because of that, because modern war is in a sense way more complicated than it ever has been, and certainly than the sort of classic 20th century warfare of sort of pitched battles of relatively proximate fighting, the allocation, and this is the second part of the argument, is continually displaced among different sets of actors, both people and technologies, intelligence that goes wrong, things that weren't passed along, military lawyers who were, and this is real, in the shower at the time that the military commander called them to make a call on a military target, but they happened to have just done a gym session and then they were taking a shower, so they didn't answer the call, so the commander went ahead anyway, and there's no legal obligation to consult the lawyer. So when you interestingly ask the military lawyers who is responsible for killing in the killing apparatus, they will turn to the fact that they are legal advisors. Any legal advisor worth their salt will always tell their client that their job is to just simply advise, but it's the client job to make the decision, and they don't bear a sort of legal responsibility for it unless it's deliberately negligent advice. And so they'll say it's the commander's responsibility. You ask the commanders, and this is something I did, and not in a measurable way, but over and over again, military commanders would tell me that they deem that the military lawyers are responsible for making their decisions. So you have this display, and that's just a simple, just trying to demonstrate that in one simple way. But you can imagine that with all of the geographies that I've just said, the technologies, well, it's not our fault because the drone imagery wasn't clear, or because someone interpreted the pole as a bomb and it wasn't, and so we went ahead. Anyway, you get the picture. And so when you add military lawyers to this mix, conventional wisdom is that they can make visible, they can make transparent all of these complications, all of these difficulties, all of these technologies of war, and bring some sort of clarity and meaning and some sort of legal truth and some sort of better objective answers to killing ultimately. But my argument is essentially that they don't. They as much obfuscate those things and cloud over those things as they do. And in order to demonstrate that, I won't go into it too much, but they invent new legal categories which help blur those lines. So I've just put two horrible acronyms there, MAM and EKIA. MAM means military age males, which was a legal sort of thing which was adopted around to say that if a drone strike took place human rights people would sort of cry out, 15 civilians have been killed, the US military would turn around and say, well, we've looked at that and we deem them to be military aged males. So if you're a man in the wrong place at the wrong time, you are de facto considered or de jure considered, a target. And EKIA is the same thing, an enemy killed in action. So this is a sort of ex post facto way of making people enemies after you've killed them and justifying that through law. Which obviously doesn't help clear the situation. If anything, it does the opposite. I'll go quickly here, but this is conceptually, this is what the US and Israeli military conceive of what they do when they target someone in aerial targeting operations. It's called the kill chain. I just wanted to put a visual representation here. It's also called, and you'll see why, it's also referred to colloquially as the donut of death. militaries are famous for their dark and cutting humor, but I think there's something about the kill chain, which I analyze, which is very bureaucratic, which is very spread out across space and time, that makes it a sort of very interesting set of processes, very boring processes, but very interesting nonetheless to study. And so all of the research, in a sense, the whole book is about the various phases of killing and what it takes bureaucratically to kill human beings and to destroy particular targets in faraway places is called the kill chain. This is just a screenshot of the scope of the book. It's sort of boring to just, you know, talk forever about it with these white pages, but just to give you a sense of the scope, as I say, I start in Vietnam, and I'll tell you why about that in a second. I talk a little bit about the rise of operational law, which comes out of the Vietnam War. America realizes that it's fought in not good ways in Vietnam, partly because they lost the war, partly because of the illegalities which were committed and the anti-war movement which came from it, has sort of become a galvanizing force for the US military to turn to and invent this thing called operational law, which is where the sort of real genealogy of my argument comes from, because that's when the US military do this conceptual work of inventing law as a force multiplier, because they have these smart military lawyers come in and say, hang on, if you reread the Geneva Conventions in X, Y, and Z, actually you see permissions as much as prohibitions. Actually, you see rights as well as responsibilities. And they sort of flip that on its head. And that's the sort of moment there. Then I look at the First Gulf War and the hideous violence of the First Gulf War. And there, the key legal thing that happens is a reading of the destruction of Iraq's electricity infrastructure and its water and sanitation facilities. It basically turns Iraq off, for want of a better expression, and does so for years because of the sanctions that came after. I spoke to all of the military planners who literally masterminded those attacks and did especially careful interviews with them, as well as the lawyers who signed off on those targets. And if we can look at the violence, I mean, we're talking about 500,000 deaths, delayed deaths from the First Gulf War. If we can look at that and not be able to identify particular war crimes, which the US military say they were not, then there's something happening. So in that moment, I think, is a turning point at which you can have violence on a mass scale, simultaneously with the claim that this is the cleanest and most legal war that we've ever fought. That was the claim. That's what sort of first started me in the study, this advertisement as the First Gulf War is the cleanest war. Then I talk a lot about Gaza and the stuff which Alex has already mentioned, not just the occupation, which is where military lawyers come in Israel and Palestine, but also the sort of successive rounds of war in 2006 in Lebanon, 2009, Gaza, 2012, including also up right up to the 2018 shooting and killing of the Gaza Great March of Return protests. And then the last couple of chapters are essentially about the US military kill chain, which is that thing, that donut of death I just showed you, the sort of really deep, bureaucratic, sort of boring process, terrible process of death, death by bureaucracy and death by lawyers. I'll end pretty soon, but what I just want to say is, part of what the book does is a very sort of specific history about the rise of military lawyers, but that's taking place alongside what people have called the juridification of warfare. That's why juridical warfare is in the title, and the increasing legalization of military legal affairs. And there's lots I could say about that, but perhaps we can leave that for the Q&A. But basically, the argument is that for various different reasons, partly because of changes in law, partly because of changes in war across the 20th century, war has become far more legalistic. Even the way that we might find ourselves consuming news and talking about the news happens to be more and more through language of law, through accusations of human rights, or saying this is a war crime, through saying you can't kill civilians because it's illegal. And partly, I think what has been lost in that vocabulary is some sort of radical ethics and politics of war. This turn to law is also a turn to legal technicalities. And as we do that, I think we cede power to lawyers to laws which, let's face it, most of us don't understand. And that's a great sort of historic loss, I argue. I'm going to skip this. And I want to finish here with this appropriate image of a sort of classic anti-war politics image from the Vietnam War. And I want to just reference where I end up in the book, which is in a strange way as the book starts in Vietnam and ends there. And it ends there for different reasons to the ones that it starts there. And it ends in Vietnam because what we had in Vietnam was something resembling a truly anti-war politics, a politics which historians are now beginning to really realize and pick up on, a politics that was against the war in its entirety, against the invasion of its entirety, in much the same way that Alex talked about the protests in advance of the Iraq War. This was protests to stop war even before they take place, and that's what happened in 1968 and successive. It wasn't a piecemeal affair. Arguments were not made about the illegality of napalm, about the illegality of only My Lai. They were, but if you look back at those discourses where particular events were identified as egregious or horrible, they were always tied to a much broader critique of war. And now if we look at that in the 21st century, I think we have a splintering of that radical politics into specific issue-led causes, like we're against drones, or we are against torture, or we're against a particular reading of the United Nations that say we shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq. All of that stuff might well be true, but I think what we lose is a broader critique of aerial violence, of military interventions. And so I end with this figure of Vietnam in order to try to get us away from law, because I think it's a slippery slope, back towards some sort of moral, legal language and ethical discourse that can serve us better for a critique of war. And so thank you so much for listening. Sorry I went a little bit over. And I really, really look forward to your questions and discussion.
Thank you, Craig, for that very powerful contribution, evoking the horrors of modern warfare and from the number of agreed permissible, foreseeable civilian deaths to the kill chain. Quite horrendous, isn't it? And the part played by military lawyers legitimizing these devastating military operations. So if we just want to have a little think about some questions and answers, are people happy to go ahead, or do you want a break first? Just go ahead. You okay, Craig, Alex?